Hi, everybody. Welcome to Heart of the Matter. I am your host, Elizabeth Vargas. And in honor of Super Bowl just 2 weeks ago, we have today on our podcast a former NFL player, Monte Ball, former running back for the Denver Broncos of the NFL, huge college athlete. He played for the Wisconsin Badgers, where he was two-time All-American, two-time Big Ten champ, Doak Award winner, and Heisman finalist for the Badgers. And of course, then he lost it all. Monte Ball talks to us about what it's like to be an athlete in recovery, about what it was like to make that transition from college sports to the NFL, how difficult it was for him, how he turned down offers of help that were extended to him at that point. And he also importantly talks to us today about what it's like to be a Black man in recovery. We know that fewer than 20% of people who need help get it, who are struggling with the disease of addiction. But it's even worse for those people of color. We know that 88.7% of African Americans do not get help for treatment of substance use disorder. So Monte is an incredible guest. I loved talking to him, and I know you will love hearing from him about how he hit rock bottom, found himself in a jail cell watching his former teammates win the Super Bowl without him, and how he got his life back together and recovered. And lastly, please take a second to subscribe and rate our podcast if you enjoy the show, because only with your support can we continue to transform the way our country addresses addiction. And now, please welcome Monte Ball. Monte, good to have you. Thanks so much for joining us on Heart of the Matter. You know, your story is pretty incredible. You were an astonishingly talented football player, won all sorts of awards, a slew of awards in college, drafted to the Denver Broncos, powerhouse team. That was a childhood dream of yours. What happened?
First off, thank you so much for having me. This is most definitely an honor. So I really, really appreciate it. And that is the million dollar question. You know, what happened to Monte Ball? You know, such a smiley kid, happy-go-lucky kid in college, you know, playing for a big time university. And yeah, what happened? I mean, a lot happened, from depression to social anxiety, which is ironic. I suffered from extreme social anxiety, which was obviously diagnosed later on, but I didn't understand how to manage all of my emotions, everything that I was dealing with while trying to maintain my position on a football team, being a student athlete, and just dealing with life in general. So I was dealing with a lot and drowning it out with alcohol.
A lot of people hear a story like yours and think, my God, you were on top of the world. You know, you were a big guy on campus, winning every award you could win as a college football player, setting records. How could somebody like him have social anxiety? How could somebody like him feel depressed? What's your answer to that?
Absolutely. My answer to that is simple. Addiction, mental health does not discriminate. It doesn't. You know, I grew up somewhat fortunate. I'm from a small town right outside. Well, it was small, but it's bigger now, but right outside St. Louis, Missouri. And, you know, most people would automatically assume that, you know, when I say that, that I grew up in a poverty-stricken area. But I didn't. I actually grew up a two-parent household, grew up in a white suburban neighborhood, went to an all-white high school. I was pretty fortunate growing up. So it was a surprise to me that that path that I went down, I chose to go down. But obviously it was mental health that kind of pushed me down that way, or the lack thereof of care with my mental health.
Well, like so many people who suffer from addiction, most people I've spoken to in recovery are drinking or using drugs to not feel something. You know, to numb something that they don't want to feel in their lives. When did the drinking for you start to really become destructive?
Yeah, so I didn't have my first drink until 17 years old. I was straight and narrow kid in high school, with the dream of always playing for the Denver Broncos. That was my entire dream since the age of eight. And so I knew that I obviously had to focus on school, stay out of trouble in order to achieve that. So in high school, did pretty well. You know, obviously experimented here and there. Like, I can count on my hand how many times I drank alcohol in high school. But then once I came to Wisconsin, about my sophomore year, so 2010, I really started to dive into the Wisconsin drinking culture, the party atmosphere, and as a kid in college with, you know, at that time, a little bit of success on the football field, I loved it. I loved it. I felt as if that was the norm. I mean, I thought, well, if these kids are at the bar, but still taking care of their academics, still taking care of, you know, some have jobs, of course, still taking care of that, then I could do it. Then it's the norm. It's the social norm. So I hopped into it, and alcohol is just not for me. I'm the one who can't handle it.
That's a renowned party school that you went to, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I've got friends who went to that school and they were like, yeah, people drink. You know, that was when many of them said they drank their heaviest, was while they went to school there.
Yeah.
So you didn't stick out like a sore thumb. Other kids were doing the same thing.
That's why I'm so glad you brought that up, because, you know, obviously hindsight being 2020, I'm like, okay, you know, I now see all of the, you know, the verbiage or the phrases that I was using. I kept saying, you know, I'm not the only one. Everybody else is doing it. Everybody else is getting drunk three times, maybe four times a week. It's literally what everybody does on campus. You see even parents in bars with their kids and stuff like that. So I felt as if that was just something I needed to do. But obviously it wasn't. I used it as a crutch. I used alcohol to suppress my emotions so I didn't have to deal with them.
Mm-hmm.
I used alcohol to sort of a way to go out and party, to step outside of my shell, to feel more comfortable talking to groups of people. It became that vice that obviously became self-destructive.
Did you have any trouble at all staying in such peak condition as an athlete? I mean, that is our very, you know, first guest on our podcast was Chris Herron, who was an incredibly talented basketball player, played college ball, played in the NBA, and, you know, he told me a story of, you know, one morning waking up wasted and having a game in a few hours and his brother telling him on the phone, what are you doing? Are you kidding? This is on national television. This is a huge game. And it was one of his best games ever. How were you able to perform at the incredibly high level you did athletically while drinking so destructively?
I'm glad you asked that, because I almost wish that I didn't perform at such a high level so that I could have stopped it then.
Right.
But since I was still performing at such a high level, I really didn't think that I had a problem. I knew, obviously, as an adult or 17, 18 year old, 19 year old, I knew that obviously I shouldn't be drinking as much as I am, but I was then up for a Heisman Award. I was then up for, you know, I broke the all-time touchdown record in the history of college football. So I'm seeing these awards. So in my mind, I'm like, okay, I'm obviously taking care of my stuff. Even when I would have conversations with my parents who obviously saw the path that I was going down, I would tell them, I'm obviously not doing anything incorrectly. I'm still achieving all of my goals. And then obviously once I was drafted by my favorite team, my childhood team, I looked right at my parents and said, obviously there's nothing wrong.
So you get drafted by the Broncos, like you said, your childhood dream. I mean, this is amazing stuff. And you go to play in Denver. What was that like and what happened with your drinking then?
Yeah. Yeah. So I always say it. I honestly, once I was drafted, I literally packed up my alcoholism and took off right to Denver, still believing nothing was wrong. And my NFL career was short, very, very short, because not only was I partying at a high level, and then in college, now you give this individual money, fame, and all the things that come along with that. I took the Denver Broncos, my opportunity, for granted. I really, really did. Of course, I still, you know, tried to take care of my business on the field, but off the field, once I took the pads off, once I left the meeting room, it was time to party. And I wish, obviously, I can go back and change that, but that was my mindset.
Did anybody, I mean, I know that you said at one point the running back coach pulled you aside and said, you smell of alcohol. Do you have a problem? And if you do, let me know. I can get you help.
Yeah. That's, good. That's my guy right there. Coach Studis. I love that man. I still talk to him today. He's running back coach for the Dolphins, I believe. And, he pulled me to the side after one of our running back meetings, and he could smell obviously the alcohol on me. So sometimes what I would do is I would go into the facility. I would hit the hot tub to flush it out real quick out of my pores, hit the steam room to do the same, and then the shower before meetings, and they would help to mask it. Well, this time I didn't, and he smelled it, and he did pull me to the side, and he noticed a pattern. He noticed the pattern, and he asked me, if I need any resources, if I need some help. And I didn't feel comfortable sharing with him that I did, because I kind of knew that I did, but I didn't feel comfortable because I felt as if I would lose some of that anonymity. I don't think that he was capable of keeping that from the head coach, that knowledge. And so I was always afraid that it would be used against me. Like if I had a poor performance, they'd say, oh, it's because he's been drinking. Or if I fumbled the football, it'd be, oh, because he's drinking. So I almost wish I did speak up.
Yeah.
Because maybe I'd still be in the NFL, but I know for a fact that's what many others are struggling with.
Didn't you have days and mornings when you were hungover and feeling sick from drinking? How did you get out there and play?
I don't know. I don't know. My rookie season, I would say about 90% of the time on Friday mornings for our practices, I was hungover. Because the previous night, I wouldn't go to sleep until about 4 a.m., 5 a.m., and we had meetings at 7 a.m.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it was pretty bad. But I don't know how I managed to still practice, but obviously, it didn't work. I mean, or I'd still be running for the Broncos right now. So it obviously caught up to me, and I'm glad that it did.
Was that running back coach the only person who ever said anything to you? Did any teammates ever say, whoa, you know, dude, dial it back?
No. I'm trying to think right now.
Do you think that's because you did a good job hiding it? Or, I know that when at the end of my drinking, before I stopped, I was very careful about how much I drank in front of people because I didn't want people to know that I was drinking too much. So I was careful not to drink everything that I might drink in a given evening in front of the same person.
Mm. That's true. I love the question because it really goes into a lot of my message now today whenever I speak to certain groups. Like if I'm speaking to the athletic program, if I'm just speaking to the football team, I really love to talk a lot about toxic masculinity and how these just thrive in locker rooms, men locker rooms. And that's what I... You know, the environment that I was around in Denver, and that kind of answers your question. There's no way that no other player saw as much as I was drinking or the excessive amount that I was consuming. Mm-hmm. I know for a fact they saw that, but you got pats on the back for it.
So you're saying your teammates did know how much you were drinking, but that was like, yo, hey, he can handle it. It was more like a badge of masculine honor?
Yeah. Absolutely, actually, yeah. And again,
and
I don't
were other players drinking as much as you?
Yeah, absolutely. There were other players who were consuming just as much as me, but just like I stated, it was that it's like this code of honor of some sort. If you do it, you don't snitch, you don't tell the coach, you don't tell the position coach. You kind of pat the person on the back, and that's that toxic masculinity that I speak of, where it's okay to. In that setting, it's okay to cheat on your wife or to have multiple partners or to excessively poison your body. And honestly, that's why I stepped away from the NFL. I had an opportunity to go back, but it's very destabilizing to, you know, where I'm at today.
You had said, I was surprised to see this, but actually maybe if I really reflect on it, not that... You loved football when you played college ball, but playing football in the NFL is a different experience. It's more of a business.
College football is it's college football. People know it's the team spirit. It's obviously you're within the same age. as everybody, you're living with a few who are on the team. There's that chemistry that's there. For me, it was difficult to obviously bond with Peyton Manning, who's X amount of years older than me, has a family at home, and stuff like that. So that aspect obviously is difficult. But yes, you mentioned it about the business side of it. It's that's something that I had to deal with once I left the NFL. Is, you know, your body, you're used as a commodity, you're expendable, and all the things that come with that. But there are a lot of perks to it. It was still a blessing.
So what happened at Denver? How did you get cut from the team?
Mm-hmm. So I got released from the team because there was a running back behind me who was undrafted, but he was performing better than I was. Mm. And by it being a business, it's, shall we keep paying the second rounder the X amount of dollars that he's supposed to make, or pay somebody cheaper who's performing better? So I saw the writing on the wall. But following Denver is when I really spiraled out of control. That was really, really when I hit my extreme rock bottom, depression, severe anxiety. I was embarrassed. I was embarrassed because...
Embarrassed because you were cut?
Yeah, pretty much fired publicly. And then you have the social media aspect of people tweeting at you, messaging you how much you suck and all that stuff. So that really ate at me. And in my story, of course, we cannot, you know, ignore the domestic violence piece. I took it out on somebody who trusted me.
You ended up at one point, after being arrested, you were in a jail cell when Super mm-hmm. Bowl 50 mm-hmm. happened. And watching Super Bowl 50 on the TV in jail, your team, the Denver Broncos. And you said that was a really, really difficult moment. It actually brought tears to your eyes.
Yeah.
I can't even fathom what might have been that were going through your mind at that point. How did I end up here instead of in the glory of a Super Bowl, you know, extravaganza? How am I in this jail cell?
Yeah. So I was fortunate. I played in the Super Bowl my rookie season when we got destroyed by the Seahawks in New York City. So against Russell Wilson, my quarterback from Wisconsin. But I have that moment, but no one remembers the team that lost. So when I was watching them win the Super Bowl from jail, to put into words how I felt is difficult because I know that I did it to myself. I was telling myself there, like, if I would have corrected myself before I would have gotten the help that I know that I needed, I most definitely would be up there hoisting that trophy in some fashion or another. So jail was tough. It's not a fun place. I was in there for 3 days, and because I got arrested on a Friday, so I had to wait out the weekend. And obviously Sunday the Broncos played, and I was in a cell with about six other people. And three of them were telling me, because I had my back turned from the television once they turned it on, and they were just going off on the mouth about how that's supposed to be me up there playing. I'm supposed to be a role model to, you know, all of the black and brown kids who are in the poverty stricken areas of achieving their dreams, showing them how it's done. And as much as I wanted to, you know, verbally fight back with them, I stopped myself because I told myself that they're right. They are right. I grew up fortunate. I grew up, you know, chasing a dream that I ended up accomplishing before the age of 30. A dream that only less than 1% of the country gets to participate in. And so that hit me pretty hard. And to this day, I still think about it, and I'm fortunate that it did happen because it motivates me.
You were in jail because of domestic violence arrest.
Right.
You don't make any excuses. You admit that you were wrong to do what you did. You ended up taking a plea deal and pleading guilty.
Yep.
That's still, however, that day, Super Bowl Sunday in jail, watching your former team win, that still wasn't your rock bottom. That still wasn't what motivated you to stop drinking.
Right.
What was?
My son. Yeah, my son. So it was a very odd time frame for me because so in September I got released from the Broncos. I spiraled out of control for a bit and then actually went to the Patriots for about 2 to 3 months. Denver beat us in the AFC Championship game, which sent us home packing them to go to face the Carolina Panthers. So I came back to Wisconsin, met a woman, and my embarrassment, my insecurities, my frustration, my confusion spewed out all over her, which I've always expressed that I'm very sorry for. And then went to jail, watched them win the Super Bowl in jail, then got out of jail. And 4 days later, a woman from Colorado tells me that she is 7.5 months pregnant. And my son was born 6 weeks later. So I had no idea that my son even existed. February 16th, she told me that he was born April 2nd. So once that happened, once I flew out there and held him, it changed my life forever because I finally realized that all of my actions, all the decisions I make are not only impacting my life, they are directly impacting someone else's life who is looking up to me and wants a healthy and happy father. So that most definitely changed my perspective, my outlook on a lot of things. It allowed for me to, and also therapy, to really understand that football was just a piece of my puzzle, not the entire puzzle. Because I really struggled with the what ifs. What if I was still being in NFL right now? Where would I be? Where would I be living, et cetera? But it put things into perspective for me for the
I'm not sure those ever stop. I do that too.
better.
I think a lot of people, I think some people manage to set that aside because we can't live in the what might have been. It's more important to treasure the what is. So is that when you stopped drinking, when you held your son, your newborn son?
Yeah, that was it for me. Because you don't go from, I knew for a fact that all the times that I've been drunk, I was never arrested, or I wasn't arrested every single time, but the times that I was arrested, I was drunk. So that it was very simple for me that I can't go, how do I go from this smiley, happy, I seem fine kid to this monster? And I knew that I had to obviously get into therapy. I had to make amends. I had to stop drinking. And that's literally what I did. I didn't blame anybody else. I'm not even blaming in a sense that it was all of alcohol. There was obviously a significant amount of insecurities that I had that I needed to address. And when I look back on things now, I'm just blessed that I corrected it all before the age of 30.
So, how do you stay sober every day, each day, one day at a time?
Yeah, it's a battle. It's a battle, most definitely is, because it's a you know when I sit back and look at it, I'm like, oh man, I'm 30 years old now, and I hopefully I live for another 60 years. How do I plan on staying sober for another 60 years? And I don't look at it as if it's impossible, but it's a challenge. I'm only being honest here. It's most definitely a challenge. So, other than my son and my family, who are my foundation. I love the work that I do here in Wisconsin. That really helps me stay sober. I currently work for the Wisconsin Voices for Recovery, where I provide resources and outreach and linkage for those who may be suffering in silence. I know that there are others out there who are just like me, who don't really know why they, went down the path that they went down. Obviously mental health and depression and anxiety, but I reach out to those folks as well and pull them into our network because I get it. I understand the challenges. I understand the confusion that lies with addiction. I understand the embarrassment that comes with it when you go and try to talk to your family members or anybody along those lines. So that is the work that I do today, and that's what really helps me to stay sober as well, outside of my family and my son.
We know that, fewer than 20% of people who need treatment for addiction in this country get it, but the numbers are even worse for African Americans. Even fewer African Americans seek treatment. Why do you think that is?
Absolutely. So, a specific grant that I work on is called our Overdose Data to Action Grant. We get our funding from the CDC, and it is specifically for our communities of color. And that is the reason why they brought me on board. I provide that linkage and resources to our communities of color because we're seeing that same data. We're trying to figure out why. Personally, I know why. In the Black community, we do not talk about mental health. We do not encourage our close ones, our loved ones, even our friends to go and speak to a therapist. Mm-hmm. I think there's that gap in education that will show obviously the benefits of receiving help. So it's a barrier. It's a very,
you think it's a cultural issue, or is it a socioeconomic issue? Is it?
I think a little bit of both.
A little bit of both.
I think with the culture aspect of it, I think I just mentioned where it's just there's no discussion about it.
Right.
Most Black people, I'm just going to be honest with you, it's the, I don't have time to worry about that. I'm trying to worry about X, Y, Z.
Right.
And then obviously the socioeconomic standpoint of it, I think there's a lack of education with insurance, healthcare, understanding how to sign up for that stuff, understanding how much, you know, your insurance will cover for, stuff like that. So it's a very thick and broad barrier that we're trying to obviously break through.
No, I know that, you know, I live in New York City, which is a very vibrant multicultural city. And yet when I go to AA meetings, for example, there are very few Black faces in those meetings. Mm-hmm. And that's not because there are very few Black families grappling with the disease of addiction.
Right.
They're just not. Maybe there are other meetings that they're, you know, where white faces would be a minority, but I go to a lot of different meetings and I'm struck by the monochromatic nature of the skin color in the meetings.
Yeah.
Same thing for Hispanics. I'm Hispanic. You know, but the same thing, I don't see a lot of Latinx people either.
Yeah, I'll be honest with you. I appreciate you mentioning that because it's true. Same for up this way in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
And one topic that I was in the other day, and I brought this topic up, was, I think another barrier that we're ignoring here is the trust factor. A lot of Black and brown people, at least up this way, are upset. They're upset about the amount of attention that white people are getting right now for the opioid crisis, and then comparing that to the attention that we got with the crack epidemic.
Right.
You know, ours was prison, 10 years, 20 years, disenfranchising these Black and brown communities. But nowadays it's mental health. It's, let's get them the help, him or her, the help that she needs, when we didn't receive that same treatment. So that is a fact that is going on. But my message as well, on top of that, as always, we got to move forward some way, somehow. So right. I make sure that every group that I jump into, I harp on that. It's the trust. Let's have some representation of, you know, the demographic that we're trying to encourage to come in here.
Mm-hmm.
Because we need to kind of break through that trust factor. It's there.
I don't think either that you can discount the stress that many communities of color experience. I mean, I remember doing an hour-long special on infant mortality in Memphis, Tennessee, which is higher than many underdeveloped countries. And part of the reason it's so high is because so many of these young mothers had no access to birth control. So they find themselves pregnant at 16. They live in these neighborhoods where there isn't a grocery store that sells any produce. They have no access to prenatal care. So they're giving birth too early to these babies. And, you know, the Memphis and the state of Tennessee pay astronomical sums of money to keep these babies alive in these neonatal intensive care units and then send them home. And nobody, and those poor children grow up in a home where there isn't enough food and there isn't enough opportunity. And the mother has to take 3 buses to get to a minimum wage job.
Exactly.
It is incredibly difficult. And unless you're inside those communities and see the stresses of those daily lives, you don't understand how hard it is. You know, people say, just get a job or, you know, go to the doctor or take a prenatal vitamin or eat more vegetables. It's impossible.
And
then we all express surprise that so many people turn to substances as a way to ease the desperation, honestly, of living like that.
I agree. And I think that's a very important conversation to have, because many people don't even understand that. When you start to talk about the other stressors that these individuals are dealing with in their communities, then it's just like you stated, then it's no longer just, hey, go get a job or anything along those lines, because there's so many disparities, from healthcare to living in a food desert to redlining, et cetera, that all play a huge factor in the lack of social services and the lack of mental wellness in these communities. I think it's a giant monster that we're trying to deal with here in Wisconsin. We actually have a meeting with the Attorney General next week or the week after, where we want to, because there's a significant lack of education with addiction in our Department of Justice here, big time. And our goal is to start implementing programs. One being, let's follow the individual out of who just got released from prison, mm-hmm. just to make sure that they have some sort of support when they're out. So we can maybe decrease their odds of getting back in prison or back behind bars. Because obviously we know the statistic there, how fast they get back in. So why don't we create something to help them along the ways when they're out? So long story short, it's together we can make a change. We can make it happen. We just have to start having these conversations.
Did you ever have any hesitation about going public with your story of recovery, your story of addiction?
At first, not really. I now that I really think of, no, I mean I was obviously a little nervous, but being in the public eye, when you make a mistake like that, it's I had that extra push as well too, where it's like you have to get it together. You have way too many people, who kids who message you and say they look up to you and all that stuff. So I not only do I want to do it for myself and my child, but I want to make amends, so the same people who were looking up to me can now see what I'm doing now. And it's I'm giving back in ways that I could never give back on the football field. And I just want to make that known to everybody, where football, you can use it as a vehicle. And mm-hmm. I was given that platform to really speak about something way greater than myself, and that's addiction.
Well, Monte Ball, you are still a role model to so many. Congratulations on your sobriety.
Thank you.
Congratulations on getting your degree. You went back to the University of Wisconsin and
yeah.
Right.
I went back to chip away, but I'm actually in school right after this. I'm about to hop into class. Yeah, hop into class. I have a few more credits to get, and then I will graduate.
Well, it reminds me of that quote. It's not how many times you fall, it's how many times you get back up.
Absolutely.
And you've gotten back up and dusted yourself off and done quite a bit with yourself. So
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Oh,
thank you very much.
Our honor to have you on the show. Thank you so much, and best of luck with everything.
Thank you very much. I love what you're doing. I love it. We need it more, and more people need to feel comfortable sharing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you so much for listening to Heart of the Matter with Monte Ball. You can find this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and our website at drugfree.org/podcast. And as a reminder, if you need help with a loved one who is struggling with substance use, you can text 55753 or visit drugfree.org. Talk to you soon.